St. Euthemius, born in Melitene in Armenia, and on your map, you can see that about 4.5 inches from the left margin near the top, in a southern part of Armenia. This place was a very worldly place. It was the home base for the 12th Legion, 12th Roman Legion, who had contingent auxiliary units all the way over to Cappadocia, to Caesarea. And all three of those initial saints that we're looking at were under the eye of the 12th Legion Fulamata. And they were known as the Thundering Legion. They were the legion that got whipped by the Jews at the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Although they regrouped and were reconstituted and were a part of the destruction of Jerusalem in 70. But now we have them assigned way up to Armenia and Cappadocia in eastern Turkey. And St. Euthemius grew up with these people as their neighbors, like we live next door to people who are at Travis Air Force Base. In any case, they were a big operation, as well as they were a heavy presence for St. Theodosius, who we'll take a look at next. But St. Euthemius was the individual who became the mentor and the teachers of St. Theodosius and St. Saba, the two in particular that we're going to take a look at. He's responsible for the founding of three monasteries, his own, St. Theostistus, where they took in new monastic ascetics who still had a lot to learn, and one, Kfar Barikha, which was way south in that fringe area by Hebron, where Caleb with Joshua went in and conquered. It was an area that was known for King Jehoshaphat when he went down those ridges to take care of those people on the other side of the Jordan River and Mount Seir in northern Arabia, who had come against the Israelites. And they destroyed each other. Their federation broke up. And all Jehoshaphat and the temple singers had to do was go down and collect all of the spoils of war. And they called it the Valley of Beracha. Well, this is Kfar Beracha, the village of Beracha that overlooked. And if you take a look at all of these monasteries, they're very close to a host of biblical events that took place that are constant reminders. You walk outside and you think, look at what the Lord did for Jehoshaphat when threatened and hadn't been provoked at all. Look at St. Theodosius' monastery. It was the end of the Good Samaritan. And, you know, you can think on that for a long, long time. And then you can go down to the River Jordan where St. Gerasimus was. And the cells actually were just overlooking the river in the sight of these soft limestone ravines. That's where they crossed on dry ground. And that's where they made a pillar of stones to commemorate what God had done for them. Everywhere you look, there is some kind of a biblical event that expressed God's concern, care, and deliverance of his people. And I think in the monastic experience, those things you build on as a part of your own experience. He established these three monasteries, and he mentored both Savas and Theodosius. And he represented the ascetics in the Judean desert at the Council of Chalcedon in 451, which continued to be an issue among some of the monastics. And St. Euthemius, St. Theodosius, and St. Savas were staunch defenders of orthodoxy, especially against those who were Monophysites and had broken off. Occasionally we'll mention the fact that sometimes within a community there's a break. Doctrinal breaks were really very, very serious. And in particular, the Monophysites would go off and establish another community, but it's curious that most of them never survived very long. And we see that St. Savas in particular, whenever someone close to him broke off for whatever reason or disagreement, he would go reconcile with them and help them build their foundation monastery even bigger, giving them materials and craftsmen and not letting a schism go unaddressed. God bless them and keep them far away. Now, St. Savas was there, you know, reconciling, trying to understand, and trying to strengthen them in where they were. We'll see this with him in a few minutes. He was admired by all. Saracens, sometimes in hagiographies, those accounts of monks and ascetics, you'll see Saracens. Those were the local Arab clans that were in the area. He was really an evangelist, and he led Saracens, nomads or Bedouins, and villagers to the faith. And he was of short stature, round face, sharp eyes, and a long flowing beard. That's the best we can get as far as the description. But I think Father John, he was a spark plug who could get her done. Get her done. He reposed in 473, and his relics remain in the monastery that bore his name. But let's take a look at those monasteries. This is his monastery that he built, and that of his companion, Theostestus. And if you didn't have a beard, or enough of a beard, you went over here for a while. until you were sort of certified in that you knew the liturgies, you knew the prayers, you knew the psalms, and you could fit into a rigorous, disciplined community with St. Theodosius. But then down here, because down this patriarchal ridge route that Abraham and Lot traveled often, just off that road down here is Kapha or Kapha Baricha, where his third one was established. Now, what do these look like? This is St. Euthemius's monastery, thanks to Google, at an industrial park just off Highway 1 from Jerusalem to Jericho. Mishmor Adumim is the name of this residential and industrial park. And this is the monastery as it's been excavated. We see here the main gate into the monastery. The church is over here, and the burial crypt under which that is accessed by a passageway and stairs down here is where he was buried. This has proven to be the oldest part of the monastery, where they had walls around the garden. They had two gardens in an L shape. We can see those a little better. this is the church, and this is the crypt, with the passageway and the stairs down below. And the gardens were over here. And this part of the monastery is the oldest part. There are some very surprising reservoirs, this being the largest. You can see here not only the wall, but the stone and mosaic floors that were found in here. This being the courtyard, and then up here we have one of the mosaics that was uncovered in the narthex of the church. Yes, sister. Sarah.
Could you ask, how big is that complex?
This is 10 meters, or about 30 feet. So we've got 200 plus feet on each side. I don't have, it would be just about an acre. Just here, but then they had gardens around, and they had other reservoirs, this being the largest one, but they had other reservoirs outside. So they had developed and were cultivating probably 5-6 acres. And then somebody had to go to Jericho or to Jerusalem for provisions. And this was a pilgrim place, a pilgrim spot. It continued until the invasion of the Persians in 614. And then there was the onslaught of the Muslims right after that, which is a very heartbreaking period through which St. Sophronius went through, because he was there when the Caliph Ibn al-Kafar took Jerusalem. They had been under siege for 2 years, and finally he had to concede the city to them. This is the crypt area right here, and this is the garden area. And then down below the crypt, this passageway, and then down into the crypt area, where is where Euthemius came, was his relics were placed there, and pilgrims began coming right away to venerate his life and his relics. They had some small cisterns inside, because rain up in the hill country wasn't a problem usually, or up in Galilee, where Josephus said the Garden of Eden realized all of her dreams in Galilee. But here, it drops off to just an inch a year or two, and then it runs off quickly, and they had to catch it and conserve it. But if you go down into these cisterns, you don't expect this, that on top is the monastery and underneath it's one huge cistern. And this is the cistern in which they would collect the water. But you can see about this time, the Romans had developed a hydraulic kind of plaster, to where they would take shells of olive oil, of olives that still had some oil in them, and they would crush them and mix it into the cement and use it as a hydraulic plaster that was waterproof and would stay intact.
There were no springs, it was only the water that they could capture?
There were springs or streams in the desert. And I've often wondered, how did these figure in the monk's itinerary during their Lenten sojourn in the wilderness? Because you have to have some water. But here we don't know of any spring, except they were at a high elevation above the Wadi Kilt, which which is where St. George's Monastery is, if any of you have been there. And there was water running from the Wadi Faran on down through the Wadi Kilt out to the Jordan River. And you'd have to go from his monastery to that Wadi Kilt that ran most of the year. It would be three or four miles. So carrying water was really a difficult task.